From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. It's nice to be here while Terry Gross is on vacation. Today, I speak with author Ed White. His autobiographical novels explore his coming of age as a gay man. Also today, I speak with festival planner Marilyn Woods. She travels the world helping cities throw parties. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue from the South African quintet Spear. And television critic David Bianculli looks at Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, the PBS special on the rise of the fundamentalist movement. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. Edmund White struck a chord for many in his 1982 book, A Boy's Own Story, when he described the perplexing rite of passage from boyhood to maturity. This fictional journey, which mirrored White's own Midwestern youth, brought him to the realization that he was gay. White's newest book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, picks up his story where the earlier book left off in prep school. It takes White through the often painful 1950s, a time when the word gay only meant jovial and lighthearted, and exhibiting homosexual feelings was considered an admission of mental illness. Ed White has also co-authored a new book of short stories which show the effects of AIDS on personal lives. It's titled The Darker Proof. White currently lives in France, where he writes for Vogue and other magazines. He's also written many other books, including novels and a journalistic look at gay America called States of Desire. I spoke with Edmund White from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked him how sick he felt in the 1950s because he was gay.
Well, I think quite sick. I mean, in other words, I went to a psychiatrist in 1954 when I was 14, and he told my parents that I was unsalvageable, that I should be put in a mental hospital and they should throw the keys away.
And you took that in and believed it?
Oh, yes, I absolutely believed it, because in those days there were really only three possible definitions for homosexuality. You were either a sinner or a criminal or neurotic. And I think that if you were educated, you chose neurotic.
You know, I've heard people talk about those times, but I don't think I really got it until I read your book in all its detail. Did other gay men feel just like you did?
You know, the odd thing is I think that the more intellectual you thought you were, the more self-oppressive you were, in the sense that you have to remember in the Salem witch trials, it was the so-called educated people who believed in witches. The average people didn't think about it much. And I think in the same way that it was educated people who were able to take psychoanalysis and really turn it against themselves.
Did lesbians feel that way too, or was there a different sense about lesbians in the culture back then?
I think lesbians felt it too, but they were a little less visible. I mean, I think the thing is that our society tends to admire and reward slightly mannish women, not too mannish, but slightly mannish, whereas an effeminate man, for instance, is very much oppressed. I mean, if you were to walk into your bank even today and see a woman who is the officer of the bank and she had on a man-type suit, you'd be rather reassured, actually. Whereas if you walked in and saw a man wearing a dress who's supposed to be the vice president of your bank, you'd be quite alarmed. And I think that oftentimes, to the degree that our society is a sexist one and it admires men and looks down on women, I think that gay men are perceived as being more like women and lesbians are perceived as being more like men. So in that sense, I think lesbians have oftentimes had fewer problems, but I think also being invisible is a problem itself. I think that gay men had to always deal with their oppression, which led to some sort of resolution, whereas lesbians oftentimes could pass, but that's a kind of suffering too.
Where did your sexual encounters take place in the 1950s, a lot of them?
In toilets, and that's what I write about in this book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, which was took a bit of doing for me, because even when I read these passages out loud, they make me blush. But I wanted to put all that down. I wanted to write about that world, because I think that it's still going on among people who haven't been able to come out. I mean, I think that there's a fairly small group of gay people in America. Then there's this vast group of people who are homosexual, but not, who wouldn't call themselves gay, in that they don't define themselves as gay. They don't know any other gay people. They don't go to gay bars. They don't dress like gay people. Oftentimes they're married men. And where they have their sex is in toilets, rest areas, or in little pornographic movie theaters.
And you still blush when you read those parts?
Well, I think I'm unusually retarded that way. I mean, even though I'm someone who wrote with somebody else The Joy of Gay Sex, and I've always been considered very outspoken, I think I've oftentimes acted ahead of my own feelings, because in real life I'm rather reserved. And sometimes an interviewer will come in assuming that I'm this terrific swinger, but I'm actually fairly conservative.
And back in the 50s, when you were in these bathrooms, did you feel guilty every time?
Oh, yeah. I think so. And I think that's one reason why I was so compulsive, because I think that if there's a large part of your behavior that you don't acknowledge, in other words, you're leading a double life. I was a member of a fraternity, and none of my fraternity brothers knew about these activities. Actually, none of my gay friends knew about them. And to this day, people who are reading this book now, old friends of mine, college friends of mine, say, I had no idea you were doing all that stuff, because it was very, very furtive. But I think to the degree it was furtive, it was compulsive. And I actually had a psychiatrist once, a woman psychiatrist, whom I don't write about in this book, but who was rather a good psychiatrist, and she said to me, you're not really going to be able to liberate yourself from this kind of compulsive sexuality until you start coming out to a few of your friends, to your family.
So you did it little by little.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you lost your youth, though, because you felt so illicit every time you had sex with a man?
I think I suffered terribly, and some people have criticized this book for being self-pitying, but I think actually that there's not that much self-pitying. There's a lot of humor in the book. I think if I were to have put in all the anguish I actually felt, it would absolutely drown the reader. I'm 48 now, and I feel that if there's some sort of God, that he made the first half of my life absolutely miserable and the second half absolutely wonderful. I mean, at least since I've been 30, I think I'm the happiest person I know. But before that, I was one of the most unhappy.
What made your guilt go away?
I think it was, in fact, coming out. I think it was having a more integrated sense of self. For me, the final step was actually working on the book, The Joy of Gay Sex, which at the time, I wasn't a known writer. The publishers were perfectly happy if I had signed a pseudonym. They didn't care whether I signed my real name or not. But for me to sign my real name to a book like that was a kind of final act of coming out, in the sense I knew there was no turning back after that, you know.
Do you, I know there's some sensitivity about this, but do you, since coming out was the thing that felt liberating for you, do you go around saying to other people who are gay and still closeted that they should come out, that it would, that you feel sure it would work for them?
No, I don't feel sure for everyone. I mean, I think that all other things being equal, it is a good thing to do. But I think that if you look at, in a broad way, at the kind of gay people who do come out, they usually do not live now in the same city in which they grew up, and they're usually financially independent. I mean, it's hard to come out because there are risks, and particularly in the whole atmosphere of AIDS backlash right now, there are even more risks.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. Did your guilt go away completely?
No, and I think that what I'm experiencing now and is something that many gay men are experiencing because of AIDS, which is a reawakening of feelings of guilt. I mean, I think that AIDS in a way has declassed many people. I mean, it shouldn't, and I think, in fact, most intelligent heterosexual people, in fact, take a very compassionate attitude toward it. But I think that Americans in general have guilty feelings about sex. I mean, whether they're straight or gay, I think it's part of their national puritanism. And I think, secondly, gay people of my generation, at least, had to go through so much junk in trying to come to terms with their homosexuality that those feelings are never completely resolved, and they can be easily reawakened.
You know what I think about when I think back to the 1950s? That was the start of the Black Civil Rights Movement. And I wonder if gay people were saying to each other at all back then, let's watch this movement. Maybe there's a lesson in this for us.
No, because I think that assumes that gay people saw themselves as a potential community, but in fact they saw themselves only as a diagnosis. And I think that what I try to show at the end of my book, The Beautiful Room is Empty, it ends with the Stonewall Uprising, which is the beginning of gay liberation, which comes rather late, that is 1969. And in the book I try to show what were the other social movements of the period that had shaped this consciousness. One of them was bohemianism, in fact. That is the whole kind of arty crowd in the 50s who were the beatniks, who were really the only nonconformist in this vast, gray, McCarthy era. And I think the second group was modern feminism, which emerged in the 60s, and which said, your personal life is political. I mean, that is what you're feeling as an individual in your relationships with other individuals is not simply the subject matter for psychoanalysis. In other words, you needn't always change in order to accommodate the status quo. You can demand that the status quo change to accommodate you. And that became a very important step, I think, for gays. And then I think finally, when at the Stonewall Uprising, which I just by a series of accidents happened to be at that uprising, when we said, gay is good, and we were shouting it, we were all laughing because it was a sort of parody of the then very popular phrase, black is beautiful. But even as we were laughing, we were sort of hearing echoes of what we were saying, and we began to take it a little bit more seriously.
Yeah. You seemed, when I read that in the book, that description of you shouting, gay is good, you did it so sensitively and tentatively, like you felt a little odd.
Well, part of the strategy of this book was to show myself as I actually was, which is as a very conservative person, because my idea is that a potentially hostile reader even would be more liberal today than that character was then. And I wanted the reader to say, oh, come on, for Pete's sake, just drop all these problems and get on with your life. And so I wanted the reader to feel relieved at the end of the book when, in fact, the protagonist does finally speak out for himself and begin to think, to accept himself.
Well, let me ask you about your ideal reader. You once said that your ideal reader, when you're writing fiction, is a cultivated heterosexual woman in her 60s who knows English perfectly but is not American. Now, why are you writing to that woman?
Because in a way, it's a very good way of screening out any kind of automatic understanding or sympathy for your writing. In other words, if the point of writing is to reach a open-hearted and willing reader, but not a reader who's already inducted into your way of seeing things, then I thought, well, a woman, yes, somebody in a different generation, yes, and who knows English perfectly, so there's no problem in reading even my rather elaborate style, but someone who isn't an American, that is, doesn't have all the same brand names. I mean, one of the things I don't like about some of the post-minimalist writing that's going on today is that it's oftentimes, I think, simply a laundry list. I mean, you name all the brand names, you name the current jingles and television ads and so on, and everybody feels kind of warm and reassured, and they think that's realism. Well, I think it's not really rendering it's not rendering our life for foreigners, for instance. It's interesting for me, for instance, living in France, and I see French people puzzling over a lot of the new American novels, and they simply don't know what the references are.
Mm-hmm. So they're writing about it in a pop culture way instead of exploring depth of character.
That's right. Yeah. I think so.
You know, in looking at culture in general, and as I read your books, I keep getting faced with this question. How is it that there are these groups in life that have all shared a history of discrimination, blacks and Jews and Hispanics and, you know, many immigrants, and yet they don't support each other now. Why is that, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that's entirely true. I mean, after all, Jesse Jackson is the only candidate for president who's actually met people who have AIDS, who's shaken hands with people who have AIDS. I mean, in the old days, in the Black Panther days, if you consider that you would expect, if you were a sociologist, you would predict that a black working-class man would have a lot of problems in dealing with white middle-class gays. But in fact, Huey Newton, believe it or not, the leader of the Black Panthers, mm-hmm. came out very much in favor of the rights of gay men, as did, and he linked up with Jean Genet, the French homosexual writer, who toured America with the Panthers. So I'm not so sure that we all oppress each other. I mean, I think that obviously Spanish culture men, Latino men, grow up in a culture that does emphasize the macho. And I think it takes a real leap of imagination and creativity for them to be able to understand the oppression of gay men. But I think some of them have taken that leap.
If that's true, though, why isn't the gay movement further along?
Well, I think the gay movement is doing pretty well, considering its actual numbers, which are fairly small. One of the heartening things I see in America now is that there used to be a real lesbian gay male split in this country,
mm-hmm.
and I think it was, and I think it was partly because lesbians could always unite with feminists, who are a vast army. I think 40% of the women in America believe more or less in feminist principles, so that's not a minority. That's a huge group of people. And lesbians had a very privileged position within that movement, whereas gay men never had a corresponding group. But now, what's interesting is that during the AIDS crisis, even though lesbians are the least personally affected in terms of their own health by AIDS, nevertheless, there's been a great deal of generosity, compassion, solidarity coming from the lesbian community toward the gay male community.
Yeah. My guest is writer Edmund White. He has two new books out now. His novel, The Beautiful Room is Empty, continues the autobiographically based story of a young man from the Midwest moving to New York and coming to terms with being gay. White has also contributed to a new book of short stories titled The Darker Proof, which features stories based in the AIDS crisis. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. I was just thinking that back in 1980, when you wrote States of Desire, and that was a city-by-city travel diary, really, describing the gay male life, the New York Times printed a somewhat negative review. And the composer, Ned Roram, wrote into the newspaper, and he chastised the Times editors for assigning blacks to review black issue books and women to do women's books and so on. And he wanted to know why a gay writer with a sense of gay history and knowledge wasn't assigned to your review. Was he right? Is that the thing that you like? Do you want gay writers to review your works?
Well, it's interesting. I don't think that is necessarily a prerequisite, but I must say I find American male heterosexuals, intellectuals, peculiarly tradition-bound. I mean, for instance, this book of mine, The Beautiful Room is Empty, came out in England before it came out in America, and it received terrific reviews everywhere, and it went number one on the bestseller list. And all of the reviews by heterosexual men, I guess they were heterosexual. Anyway, nobody mentions their own sexuality. But here, if the man who reviews my book happens to be heterosexual, he'll spend a good third of the book a good third of the review establishing his own sexual credentials, which I find a big bore and not very civilized. It just seems to me really ridiculous. But, a typical review in an American paper by a man will say, well, I found this really difficult to come to grips with, and I really had to struggle with this one, but in spite of my encumbering heterosexuality, I was able to somehow... Well, mm-hmm. I find that absurd. For instance, we've all read Native Son by Richard Wright. We've read books by... If we're men, we've read books by women. If we're American, we've read books by Chinese. It's absurd to... act as though it's so difficult to make this particular leap of imagination.
Yeah, there's more angst here about it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have separate interests, this personally, in how the gay community responds to your work and then how the more straight media respond?
Well, I suppose any movement like the gay one has a lot of tiny elements and even a kind of lunatic fringe who are more militant than I'll ever be or more separatist or more something or other. Anyway, you can't pay too much attention to that. I don't. I have frequently been attacked by gay critics for things that I don't take too seriously.
Minutia, you mean?
Yeah. Or, for instance, in the early days of the gay movement, it was considered very important for gay writers to always show gay life in a positive light and to present positive role models. Well, I think that's a rather Stalinist approach to literature. And I've only felt obliged to show gay life as it is, not as it should be. And
Do you feel that? You must feel that pressure on you, because here's a movement obviously searching for political leaders.
Yes. Well, I think this new book, actually, The Beautiful Room is Empty, is my most politically progressive and maybe politically committed book that I've ever written. Because, as I say, in the early days of gay liberation, in the early 70s, I never paid much attention to the movement, because I felt like fiction shouldn't have to embody political principles. But now that the gay community is so in danger, and people are predicting that half of all the gay men living in the major cities in America will be dead in another 2 years, if that's true, and I certainly have lost my share of friends, it seems to me that gay experience is really in danger of being forgotten, wiped out. So it makes me, at least, write with a kind of new urgency.
Have you lost a lot of your friends?
Oh, yeah, over 20, including my best friend and my editor on this very book, in fact.
I'm sorry.
Well, thank you.
In this other book that you've done, the one you co-authored with Adam Mars Jones, the stories are all about people living with AIDS or the specter of AIDS.
Right.
And you almost never mention the word AIDS in the book.
Well, yeah, I think that the reason we did that was because we felt like one of the things we wanted to do is we felt that most of the coverage of AIDS that there's been up until now has been from the press, and it's usually been experts who may or may not be gay, but experts in their capacity as scientists or doctors talking about this as a phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And what's been left out of the equation has been the personal side of it, what it actually feels like to live through all this. So we wanted to, both Adam Mars Jones, Adam's one of England's better young writers, I think, and he and I wanted to reclaim some of this territory for ordinary lives, because homosexuality, after all, is a word that was invented by a doctor in the 1860s, and ever since, it's been a subject that's been very medicalized, always under the precinct of psychiatrists and doctors and endocrinologists and God knows what. And one of the accomplishments of gay liberation was to roll this back and to make some space for ordinary people to lead their lives. But now, because of AIDS, the whole situation is in danger of being re-medicalized. Anyway, we didn't want to use the word AIDS because I think people have a whole set of automatic responses when they hear that word and see it, mm-hmm. and a little curtain descends in your mind and you know what you think. We wanted to keep things open. That's also the reason that I think we wanted to write short stories instead of novels about this subject. Because if you write a novel, it has a kind of inevitable trajectory which ends with the death of one or several of the characters. A novel about AIDS.
Yeah.
Whereas a short story is something that cuts into the subject at an odd angle and gets you in and out of it in a rather in a way that you can control, and that throws, we hope, some sort of odd and new light on the subject.
Yeah. I found that I had dreams about the story, so it must be working. My guest is writer Edmund White, author of The Beautiful Room is Empty and The Darker Proof, Stories from a Crisis. You're living in France now. Why did you go there?
Well, I went to Guggenheim, which took me there for the first year, and then after I got there, I got a wonderful job with Vogue magazine, which is really the best job I've ever had in the sense that it gives me the most free time to do my own writing. And yet still pays my rent. But I also find it's interesting to live in another country. I mean, Gertrude Stein said she liked living in Paris because she felt she was the only person who spoke English there, that it was her private language, and she had a new relationship to the language. I know I've never written in a simpler or more American way than since I've lived in France. I mean, when I lived in the States, I think I was always longing to be in Europe, so I used a lot of foreign words in a very elaborate kind of Jamesian style.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think that I'm living in France, things are becoming simpler and more American.
Was there any sense of relief in getting there to sort of be away from the way that this country looks and talks about AIDS? Was there any difference there?
Well, at first there was, because there were fewer cases, but now France has the most cases in Europe, and I've lost several friends since I've lived in Paris, and also, I became active in a group that provides all kinds of services for AIDS patients in Paris. I was one of the people who founded the Gay Men's Health Crisis in New York, and then when I went to France, I got involved with this group called AID, A-I-D-E-S.
I know that AIDS is pushing so many people to think about what's important in life. Has that made you reorder your work at all?
Oh, yes. I mean, I feel like I work much more quickly now, simply, directly, I hope more sincerely. I'm now writing a biography of Jean Genet, and I see that even as part of my AIDS work in the sense that if gay culture is in danger of being wiped out, I think it's important that a few monuments be left behind to the real geniuses. And I think that Genet is one of the two or three great writers of the century, and yet who's been curiously undervalued because he emerged in an atmosphere of scandal, both in France and in this country. And, you know, he was a Grove Press author and somehow linked in people's minds with Henry Miller and other dirty writers, D.H. Lawrence, quality lit but dirty. And the truth is that Genet, I think, along with Céline and Proust, is one of the three great stylists in French in this century. And one of these amazing people who really invented himself. I mean, in the sense that he didn't begin writing until he was in his 30s. He was a prisoner. He'd been a prisoner or in and out of prisons most of his life. And suddenly he erupted into print with this fantastic stuff, which is not the kind of simple, naive writing that you would expect from a prisoner, but in fact some of the most elaborate and beautiful prose of this century.
And so that's inspiring to you.
Yes, very much.
Well, I hope it goes well for you.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer Ed White. His new novel is titled The Beautiful Room is Empty. It's published by Knopf. He and writer Adams Mars Jones are featured in a new book of short stories set in the era of AIDS. It's titled The Darker Proof, and it's published by New American Library. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with theater director and actor Austin Pendleton. He's worked with Chicago's Steppenwolf Theater and the Williamstown Theater Festival. He's also appeared on Miami Vice and St. Elsewhere and directed Elizabeth Taylor in Little Foxes. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation for another week. Coming up, I speak with Marilyn Woods. She throws parties, big parties. As a festival planner, Woods has organized celebrations for thousands of people, like the Hong Kong Arts Festival and the Riverfront Celebration in Columbus, Ohio. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews In the Townships, a 1973 album from the South African group Spear that showcases the work of saxophonist Dudu Pukwana. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews the public television special, Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. Secretary of State George Shultz says he is delighted with his latest talks with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, even though he's not been able to get Shamir to approve his peace plan for the Middle East. Hugh Schofield reports.
In public, at least, Mr. Shultz remains committed to his original timetable, which calls for an international conference to be convened as early as 2 weeks from now. No one really takes it seriously, though, and after his meeting today with Mr. Shamir, the prospects for early movement on the peace process look as far away as ever. In the event, they decided to avoid those crucial issues, such as the international conference, that continue to divide them. And there still seems little likelihood of Mr. Shamir coming out with a final yes or no. Meanwhile, Palestinians in the territories staged a general strike to protest against Mr. Shultz's visit. There was more violence, too, and an 18-year-old was shot and killed in a clash with the army.
Hugh Schofield reporting for the BBC in Jerusalem. Panama's General Manuel Noriega wants Democratic presidential candidate Jesse Jackson to help keep the U.S. out of Panama's internal affairs. Noriega wrote to Jackson after the civil rights leader wrote to him. Jackson says his interest is to relieve the suffering of the Panamanian people and to remove Noriega. At the State Department, spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley says the U.S. has channels available to Noriega when they're needed, and it would be best to stick with those channels exclusively. The Reagan administration will begin sending 1,300 troops to Panama tomorrow. Colorado holds presidential precinct caucuses tonight, with Vice President Bush expected to win among Republicans. On the Democratic side, the race appears to be between Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis and the Reverend Jesse Jackson. We have more from Mark Roberts of member station KCFR in Denver.
Republican leaders say Republicans attending tonight's caucuses may have little to talk about. Vice President Bush's nomination, they believe, is a foregone conclusion. Pat Robertson supporters, however, say they could win a third of the votes here in Colorado. As for the Democrats, political analysts say the race is between Jesse Jackson and Michael Dukakis. Both candidates campaigned in the state over the weekend. Jackson, appearing at a local Baptist church on Sunday, packed the pews and drew big crowds everywhere he appeared in the state. For his part, Dukakis has spent less time in Colorado than Jackson. Colorado Democratic leaders say it is difficult to predict the outcome of the Dukakis-Jackson contest. They do say, however, that the key element could be the Hispanic vote. The way Hispanics vote in Colorado could also provide an indication of how Hispanics will vote in upcoming elections in New Mexico, Arizona, and California. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Roberts in Denver.
Police in West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky are searching for three convicted murderers who broke out of the West Virginia penitentiary at Moundsville overnight. David Demarest reports from Wheeling.
Warden Jerry Hedrick says prison guards started the search when they went to Tommy Lee Mollahan's cell to give him his medicine before bed, and he wasn't there. Hedrick says Mollahan, Bobby Stacy, and David Williams apparently climbed down some elevator shafts, broke through walls, and from there climbed down a cable to the ground. Hedrick says he's confident someone picked them up at the gate and drove off. All three were serving life sentences without chance of parole for murder, and Hedrick says they should be considered dangerous. But the people of Moundsville aren't concerned. They've lived in the shadow of the penitentiary for years, and they say they know they're safe.
Why, they won't stick around here. They'll take off to the hills.
They figure that, they're gone. They don't even stick around this area.
They either hide until it's safe to run. They don't seem to ever bother anything close by.
Warden Hedrick says it's anybody's guess where the three went. For National Public Radio, I'm David Demarest in Wheeling, West Virginia.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 7 points to close at 1980.60. Declines led advances nearly 3-1. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new reissue of a recording by alto saxophonist Dudu Pukwana. Pukwana was born and raised in South Africa and played in various groups in Port Elizabeth and Cape Town before emigrating to England almost 25 years ago. He's worked there with both English and South African musicians. In the early 70s, he made an album in the United States with exiled countryman trumpeter Hugh Masekela. But for the most part, Pukwana is little known here. Kevin hopes this new reissue will change that.
Given the media's fascination with Soweto pop and repressed Soviet jazz, it's odd that South African jazz musicians haven't attracted similar attention. Their music's down home enough. Maybe it's because so many players went into self-imposed exile in the 60s before apartheid became a major news story. A few of them came to the States, like trumpeter Hugh Masekela and pianist Abdullah Ibrahim, then known as Dollar Brand. Others wound up in England. In 1964, an interracial quintet called the Blue Notes left Cape Town to play some concerts in Europe and never went back. Its members settled in London, helping to spark England's rich modern jazz scene. Among the Blue Notes were alto saxophonist Dudu Pukwana and trumpeter Mangezi Feza. In the early 70s, they guided an emigre quintet known as Spear, with Bizu Ikana on tenor sax and Pukwana doubling on piano. In 1973, they cut an album called In the Townships, which was issued only in England and has long been out of print. It's now out in the U.S. under Pukwana's name on the world music label Earthworks. Spear's sound was firmly rooted in an upbeat South African street music called Kwela, but it also bears the stamp of some American cousins. Pukwana has acknowledged the liberating influence of Ornette Coleman's shouting free jazz, but he owes at least as much to gritty R&B saxophonists like King Curtis. Here's an excerpt from Pukwana's Sekela Kluma. By American bebop standards, this is pretty crude stuff. Way out of tune, rhythmically wobbly, and about as harmonically inventive as Hang On Sloopy. But Spear's blend of simplicity and spirit and some very catchy melodies make up for any failings. Mangezi Feza's tune Sonia became something of an Afro-jazz standard and was covered by art rocker Robert Wyatt. Thank you.
fierce hypnotic music, the interplay between the soloist and a choir of horns bridges the distance between Kansas City swing bands and African vocal and percussion ensembles. It reminds us how tenaciously black musicians everywhere cling to African roots. If Spears' infectious sound grabs American ears now, fame will come too late for a couple of its members. In 1975, trumpeter Mongezi Feza had a nervous breakdown and was admitted to an unheated English hospital where he caught a fatal dose of pneumonia. In 1983, bassist Harry Miller died of injuries sustained in a car crash while on tour in Holland. But Dudu Pukwana and Spears drummer Louis Maholo, another ex-Blue Note, are still active on Europe's new jazz scene and still drawing on the music of the townships they left 24 years ago.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed a reissue of In the Townships, an album by Dudu Pukwana and Spear on the Earthworks label. This is Fresh Air. Marilyn Wood is a leader in the new participatory art form she calls celebration. Using dance, film, sound, lights, and the sculpture of the city environment, Wood designs and choreographs large-scale city festivals. She's worked all over the world in such cities as Tehran, West Berlin, Adelaide, Tokyo, New York, and Columbus, Ohio. Marilyn Wood began her career in New York as a dancer with Merce Cunningham and Alwyn Nicolai. I asked her how dance led to celebration.
When it came time to do my own work, the dance world had always seemed a little bit too small. And I wanted to include everything I love in what I would do personally. And so I began to sort of almost itemize that. And I thought, well, I love color and, of course, movement. I love architecture, spatial kind of experience, children, playgrounds, communal things, participative energy. These are things that turn me on. And so I was sort of grasping intuitively for a way to put that kind of experience together with the expertise that I developed in the art world. So I guess that would be the genesis of my direction toward what ultimately I came to understand was celebration as a form.
Do you think of the city as a canvas or a stage?
I feel that in our culture, the arts have been put on the side. It's like the exquisitely initiated people are only the ones who can do it. And it takes place in these mausoleums of culture, theaters, galleries, museums, and so forth. And traditionally, throughout history, art has been immediately in the middle of life. And all the major issues of life are celebrated and acknowledged through the arts of that period and that culture. And they're wonderful traditions in everywhere around the globe, and they're still alive and well in most traditional cultures. And I feel that that's missing in our society, and I'd like to bring all the arts out where, again, it becomes accessible, visible, participatory, an experience that we're in instead of looking at.
In a celebration, you've had firewalls bursting into flames, mountain climbers rappelling down the sides of glass skyscrapers, fireworks, dancers silhouetted in the windows of skyscrapers, thousands of helium balloons, you know, thousands of singers in unison on the street. How do you diplomatically explain these kinds of events to a city bureaucracy?
What helps a lot, and I've been doing this now for over 15 years, is that I have a lot of visual material which proves that I've done this in other cities. Earlier on, of course, it was harder, and I had some very visionary people supporting my efforts, so that I have now the evidence that I've put dancers in windows and sculptures down buildings and mountain climbers and projections on the whole wall of buildings and so forth. I have a lot of visual material to show, and that inspires people. This city has done it. This city has done this. And this city here, too, should have this. Some very personal expression which showcases your environment, expresses your cultural resources, your whatever they are, gives your artists a chance to get out and reach and connect with a much, much larger audience than they normally do, and so forth.
You work with a fire sculptor in some of your events. What's that all about?
What he does is he draws his images in fire, which are, it's cold flame. It's ignited only at the moment of performance. If it's carried by performers on roller skates, then it goes flashing through the streets. In Berlin, we call these startle events, and they're heading in one direction, and it says, hey, something amazing is going to happen, and it's going this way. Sometimes he writes and animates the entire facade of a building, as he did in Frankfurt on the Opera House on the Solstice Day, where he wrote sun in giant letters in fire. He has his own, well, it's really magic. I mean, we're not going to give our secrets away, but it's not dangerous. It doesn't harm the building. And he's one of those amazing artists that are coming out of the woodwork now to address the scale and the intention of celebration and define forms that thousands of people can relate to visually from the environment and that make something extraordinary, exciting, and unique.
You do these celebrations around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a different spirit or motivation in other countries doing festivals?
I think that it's better understood in most other parts of the world because they have more of a connection with a long, long, unbroken history of festival and celebration, ritual, ceremony. Now, we're a new country, and we had some traditions in our culture initially of barn raisings and so forth that came from our agrarian society. But when we shifted then to a major urban kind of lifestyle, that became to some extent eroded. And I think we're still in the process of looking for forms that make sense in the scale of our cities now, which are beyond what are the two major forms we have now are football games and parades, both of which are passive. We're watching. We need new traditions of festivals which engage everyone directly in the energy of the event in public space.
When I think about anthropology,
mm-hmm.
I know there's a sensitivity about visiting a place and imposing your own values on that place.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance between, you know, letting the honesty of the local community shine through
mm-hmm.
and yet bringing in all this flash?
Well, quite honestly, in addition to being a choreographer who has been a dancer and an artist, there's a whole domain to the art of celebration that I've had to invest a lot of exploration and training in. And that can only be identified by a word that's kind of a little tricky in our culture, but it has to be admitted, shamanism. Shaman is that person in the community that is sensitive and tuned in to the collective imagery, to the sensibility amongst that everyone is in agreement about, and can bring that out into some kind of expression in a ritual or a ceremony or a festival. So when I come into a community, it's very important. My first task is for me to discover, where am I? What is it like here? And what is the imagery of these people about this place? And what are their cultural forms and their cultural resources and so forth? And to somehow tap into all of that and then look at the environment, work with the local artist and the community to discover what we want to do together. Now, if that vision does not address their genuine values and concerns, then I'm just an aggressive outsider coming in and pushing people around, and it will never, never work.
So do you talk to them like a movie director would? Do you sit there and say, all right, this is going to happen over here, and then you're going to be over there, to help them visualize how it's going to look on the canvas?
Sure. And see, they've seen my visual material. They know the scale and the kind of style of my way of working. Then we go look at the site, and they say, we could do this, or why don't we do that? And the ideas just flow. We're brainstorming together. And somehow out of that process, we shake down to something that makes sense But then, once we begin, of course, it all shifts somewhat, just like when you put your first brush on the canvas. You can't predict exactly how the painting will be, even though your intention is to make a painting about a certain subject.
Well, do these events surprise even you?
Of course. And I love the surprises. I don't want to just repeat myself. That's never my intention. So I'm always looking for something that's never come up before, a direction that's never been presented or explored. And I love the experience of having things evolve out of this collective process that I could never have imagined in advance.
You've obviously made peace with the idea that the celebration, which is this art form, for you, is here one day, and then it's gone. You know, it's replaced with all the people scurrying back to work, cooking their dinners, going about normal life. How does that feel?
Well, to begin with, I'm a performing artist, and it is always an ephemeral form. Who can own a dance? Who can own a piece of music? I mean, of course, we can market it in a certain way, but dancing is one of the most difficult things to sort of market, to merchandise, to so forth. It's a fleeting, transitory thing, but it is very, very powerful in the way it imprints in our imaginations. I think in our culture, we invest so much in the material level, and we don't have confidence that in this ephemeral domain, there is permanence, there is power, and it remains. It doesn't disappear.
Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
Marilyn Wood spoke to us from the NPR studios in New York. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in now with co-host Robert Siegel to see what they have planned. What's going on, Robert?
Hello, Faith. Well, we're following the last day of campaigning in Wisconsin. Tomorrow is the Wisconsin primary. And we hear about the special rules. Wisconsin is an open primary. It means that you don't have to be a registered this or that to vote in this or that primary. That has led to reports that the Republican governor has tried to stimulate a bit of Republican crossover voting for Jesse Jackson, thinking that that might gum up the works for the Democrats. Also, we'll check on the latest involving General Noriega in Panama. And on the 20th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., we see what's happening nowadays in Memphis, Tennessee.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Everywhere you look these days, television evangelists and religious fundamentalists are very much in the news. Their politics, their morals, their true confessions. This week, public television is airing a documentary about the religious right. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
In the beginning was a documentary called Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, and it was pretty good. It was scheduled to be shown on Frontline last May by PBS, and it was all about the rise of the religious right, the growth and sophistication of televangelism, and a behind-the-scenes visit with a TV preacher named Jim Baker.
I think the church today, and especially the church world that I live in, is filling a great void and a great need in people's lives.
Why is there this hunger and void in America?
We've had everything. Rich kids are on drugs. You know, they've been given everything. They have lovely cars, they have lovely homes, and their fathers make fine money, and they give them wonderful things, and yet they go out and become drug addicts. And they try drugs, they try alcohol, they try sex, and when it's all wiped out and you've had it all, you know, life falls apart.
There's a lot of irony there. Jim Baker with his giant empire talking about how rich kids can be corrupted by sex. Less than a month before this documentary was scheduled to premiere on Frontline, the Baker scandal broke and the documentary was yanked, supposedly because the scandal made the program dated. Most broadcast news organizations would have killed for the footage contained in filmmaker Anthony Thomas's show. Never again would the media be likely to get such wide access to Baker's empire or get such a good look at Jim Baker's true philosophies. Thomas interviewed Baker when Baker was at his zenith, at his most confident and at his most unguarded. But Frontline jettisoned the show at the last minute, and it appeared to be dead, until protest groups, TV critics, and other interested parties attended private screenings of the two-hour documentary and kept pressuring PBS to reconsider. Finally, PBS agreed and is presenting a re-edited 90-minute version this week, but as a standalone special, not as part of Frontline. The politics behind the show are as interesting as the politics on the show, but if PBS wants to be known as the network that strikes while the iron is cold, that's their problem. As for Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, the edited version is just as potent as the original. Even though Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart have grabbed all the headlines, the most interesting interview here is with the Reverend W.A. Criswell, the Dallas fundamentalist who embraced Ronald Reagan in 1980 and basically launched the religious right into the political arena. Filmmaker Thomas softly presses Criswell about why his churches in Dallas are still segregated, and Criswell's answer is amazingly racist.
Birds of a feather flock together. People of a like background sort of gravitate toward each other, and they don't mix very well. Let's take the black. It seems to me that he is by nature responsive to God. He sings. They'll have preaching all day long. They seemingly never tire of praising the Lord God.
Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done is worth watching because we don't often see such religious leaders on TV away from the pulpit. Some of us, in fact, rarely watch them at all. And that's Thomas's point. The media didn't surround Jim Baker until he fell. But the real story may be how easy it was for him to rise.
The PTL Television Network presents Jim and Tammy.
Praise the Lord. See the things that he has done.
David Biancooley is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, the 80s are almost over and none too soon for Cynthia Heimel. The author of Sex Tips for Girls and But Enough About You says it's been a tough decade for women. Rock historian Ed Ward will profile the Belmonts, the singers who backed up Dion. The Belmonts later went their own way, and Ed describes one of their records, Street Corner Symphony, as one of the most beautiful albums of all time. And book critic John Leonard will review The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, the first novel by Michael Chabon. I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KSOZ in Point Lookout, Missouri. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Dougherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.